From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. I'm Elvis Mitchell. And what can you say here in early 2022 about a novel that in its early section includes the line, with a virus, you could inoculate, you could isolate, you could watch physical symptoms. But this was something heretofore unseen in human existence, an act of collective surrender. And that's the opening of the book. The book is Anthem. My guest is Noah Hawley, who was last here for the terrific last season of Fargo. He's given us such shows going from The Unusuals to Legion. And this book goes from the Slave Amendment to the philosophy of biologist Everett Wilson. Of course, the author, again, of Anthem is my guest, Noah Hawley. Noah, it's a pleasure to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
It's incredible because I can't talk to you about the book and not ask how much is influenced by the era in which we're living now, because it's full of stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I just honestly set out to tell a story about people who do things. And I thought, well, when is it set? And then in deciding that it was set in our contemporary America or in our near future, I was forced to ask, well, what does our near future look like? And then that became this huge dive into, you know, where we are and how we got here and you know, the reality that we, you know, we talk about polarization, but really what we have is two Americas, what's described in the book as the kingdom of Wall Street and the kingdom of Main Street. And, you know, one is a sort of worships the god of reason and the other lives more emotionally and instinctually. And, you know, in order to tell a story set in contemporary America, I sort of had to present what that is. And so the book became a kind of epic fantasy quest, what I describe as a fantasy novel about the real world or a realistic novel about the fantasy world that we're living in. But it's both at the same time.
Well, so much of it is something we talked about when you were last here, which is what faith means for people. And faith is really kind of the foundational aspect of the book, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a moment in the book, the young protagonist Simon, who, you know, is a rich kid who's been in a sort of private psychiatric hospital to treat his anxiety. And he thinks about this kingdom of Wall Street and the kingdom of Main Street. And he said, you know, clearly one of these kingdoms is living a sort of delusional life, but what if it's us? What if it's the people who believe that, you know, we should trust the science? And, you know, maybe Einstein or Galileo, that was the beginning of a kind of break from the emotionally instinctive world of faith that everyone else lives in. We have this delusion on the left that if everybody else just understood the facts, then they would see the world the way we see the world. But I think we're learning people see the world differently, and they always will. But we still have to figure out a way to talk to each other and govern together and create a community together.
I guess so. It's got this thing that I associate with you as a creator, which is characters looking for tribes.
You know, we're a tribal animal. We're a community-based, a family-based animal, very social. The worst thing that you can really do to people is isolate them. I think we're seeing that over the last couple of years, that it's only making things worse when we lock down and we keep apart from each other. But, you know, it's also becoming increasingly heated and confrontational in our public spaces. And so people are starting to opt out of community because it's starting to feel so dangerous. And of course, that in and of itself is dangerous, because we got to get out there and mix it up and hear other people and walk in their shoes and in order to be able to care about them.
More so than anything you've done, this is really a book about people choosing not to listen to each other, which is really where, I guess, the aroma scene comes in. And I wanted to talk to you about that, because so often you have a couple of people who are sort of nose to nose who can't hear each other. But we have in this apocalypse society, as this literal and figurative plague is raging through, Simon passed through a number of places where nobody's listening to each other.
For me, on some level, that goes back to Fargo, right? Which, you know, Joel and Ethan's movie is a tragedy. It's the sort of tension between comedy and tragedy. And the tragedy is really about the inability of these characters to communicate with each other. It's, you know, it's Jerry Lundegaard, Bill Macy. And if he could just say out loud the truth to somebody, he could avert the whole tragedy. But he can't. He can't even finish a sentence. He's so, you know, afraid of his own thoughts. You know, a lot of what Fargo is that tragedy of miscommunication. And certainly it feels now like we're seeing an inability to communicate, either to fully understand each other or even to listen, playing itself out in a way that's, you know, increasingly dangerous. And, you know, I live in Austin. You know, I made a conscious choice to live in the middle of the country because I do want to tell stories to everybody. There are these coastal bubbles and, you know, and not even coastal, but sort of urban versus suburban or rural bubbles. And you got to get outside of them in order to really see people that aren't necessarily thinking the same things that you're thinking and living the way that you're living.
Knowing Austin, basically once you drive any direction like 5 miles outside of Austin, it's a different world, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very, you know, even Austin itself is a more libertarian place, if that ideology still exists, than, say, New York. There is a combination of a kind of artistic sensibility combined with a kind of rugged individualism that you find a lot in the sort of, I guess, what I would call the real Texas. You know, that is distinctive. My wife is a seventh generation Texan, and my father-in-law lives around the corner from us. There's definitely windows that I have into just a very different world than I grew up in Greenwich Village.
It's funny you were saying that, the real Texas. You reminded me of that line from the book. Louise thinks this is her first time in what people on NPR call America.
Right. Yeah, that's the question, is what is that real America? And it's, you know, it's interesting to me, starting to think about maybe a final season of Fargo. I pitched Fargo originally as it's the people we long to be, sort of simple and kind and honest, versus the people we fear the most, the, you know, vicious and unfeeling. And so our protagonists are always, in Fargo, this sort of embody this kind of traditional folksiness, you know, the simplicity of you know, Patrick Wilson saying, I own two pairs of shoes, right? One for winter, one for summer. I'm not a complicated guy. And yet now you look at the school board meetings and who is there threatening to kill the educators on some level except these simple, kind, and honest folk who would describe themselves as such. And so, you know, that folksiness, you know, when you think about that battle between the vicious and unfeeling and the honest and generous, you think, well, maybe we've lost, you know, maybe the vicious and unfeeling people have taken advantage of those people who just, they want to feel safe, they want their kids to grow up right, et cetera, et cetera. Because ultimately, when you look at the world, what you see is the victory of cynicism, in which you have a lot of well-vaccinated people telling other people not to get vaccinated. And that feels like a very cynical act.
It's the treatment we're talking about, cynicism and more, faith, with my guest, Noah Hawley, creator of so many things. We know him for things from The Unusual, actually one of my favorite shows, The Unusuals, to, of course, his run on Fargo on FX. And his latest novel is Anthem. As you were talking about that, though, I was thinking about that section near the end of the book where it's mentioned in the narration in the 80s, professional wrestling coined the phrase kayfabe, which was defined as the thing we all know is fake, we agree is real. And the follow-up line to that is, It's all kayfabe now.
Yeah, I mean, I remember watching, you know, wrestling in the 80s, the Superfly Snuka era, and, you know, the performative, the soap opera nature of it. And of course, everyone knew that it was fake. But, you know, there was this collective agreement that the dramas that they invented in wrestling, you know, were real and we could invest in them. And then, of course, who became a staple of World Wrestling Federation but Donald Trump? He became a character in this drama that's pretended to be real but wasn't. No one is saying, I'm not, certainly not saying that that's the root of all our problems is wrestling, but it is a kind of collective investment in artifice as reality. You know, the birth of quote reality television, right? Which none of that was real either. You know, it's a sort of fascinating thing that happens when you replace reality with the simulation of reality that appeals to people's instinctual nature for good versus evil and, you know, trying to reduce the world to something simple that makes sense.
And I want to get back to Anthem because one of the things it really is, it's so expansive, not only in terms of narrative, but in terms of philosophical offering. And it also does this thing that you like to do, and you're talking about it with Fargo, which is creating a sense of community. And you do that at the very opening with characters who we get immediately invested in, the judge and her husband and this whole new family and new life they sort of creating there in this place where, and her husband, and it's this kind of idyllic and realistic summation of their lives. But also we're aware too of the problems they face as people of color. You use it as a way to pull us into this natural disaster that comes into play.
Yes. And you know, it was important to me that the story, as I would lay it out briefly, is, you know, two tracks. One is this, let's call her a conservative judge, the woman who's on her second marriage, who is nominated for the Supreme Court by a president of the opposite party. And she finds out when she goes to visit her grown daughter in Austin, but what she discovers is a kind of Marie Celeste mystery in which there's a meal uneaten on the table, their bags packed but not taken, and her daughter and her daughter's boyfriend have vanished. On a parallel track, you have a group of young people who've been in this private psychiatric hospital who break out in order to go on a quest to save a princess in a tower, basically. And you realize that those stories are connected. In order to go on that quest, they have to go out into through the American landscape as it exists today.
You introduce those characters. And because, again, what you do so often is, I was saying, create a sense of community. And you set them in the real world, or a world that feels incredibly real to us. And so almost paragraph by paragraph, we're watching that world disintegrate. But also, even as this kind of fantastical element is being introduced, we feel these real world tensions of her husband being a man of color and being in the streets of Brooklyn.
Never in the book do I use the word Democrat or Republican, but I do spend a lot of time kind of trying to figure out other ways to describe the political parties. One of which is to say that there's the party of truth and the party of lies, but each party believes that they're in the party of truth. So in other words, the party of truth is in power now. And before that, it was the party of truth, but it was the other party. And that, you know, there are other sorts of attempts to look at it from these characters' points of view. As the judge says, everyone has a theory and the internet has allowed us all to be right. So we all go through life thinking, well, I have this theory and I can go online and I can find enough proof and enough people who feel the same that I can create my own community.
There's a lot to talk about here. It's the treatment, I guess, is Noah Hawley, whose new book is Anthem. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. We're talking about a lot of things, primarily the book Anthem with my guest, Noah Hawley. We, of course, know him from his incredible work on the show Fargo. And there's the chapter in the book Cliffs, which in a big part is about how faith can be perverted by zealots. And that feels like almost this kind of summation of a lot of your thoughts in that chapter.
There is this idea, you know, at the heart of the book is about the contagiousness of ideas. And one idea in particular, which is suicide, you know, an idea that kind of spreads among young people, this collective surrender that you referred to earlier. Our protagonist, Simon, you know, falls in with a character called the Prophet, who is a 15-year-old boy, but who claims that God is speaking to him and that they have to go on this quest together. And, you know, there's a moment where the Prophet is explaining that 33% of Americans believe that angels walk among us and that angels and demons are real and all these things. And Simon says, well, what do you believe? And the Prophet says, well, I believe the more that we believe in them, the realer they become. And Simon, of course, says, well, that's not how it works. But maybe it is how it works. You know, there is that sense in the book that the more that we give in to a worldview in which magic is real, then the realer magic becomes. You know, I remember in 2016 seeing Newt Gingrich on television during the run-up to the election, and he was telling the CNN correspondent, he said, crime is up all over America. And she said, no, it's not. That it's a fact. It's not up. And he said, well, people feel like it's up, and that is also a fact. And I remember that moment really clearly where I thought, wait, what just happened? Because there's the fact that crime is not up, it's down. But this feeling that it's up is also a fact. And, you know, that signaled a real shift for me, because that feeling that it's up is more important to a large number of people than the reality that it's down. And I think we're seeing the repercussions of that. You know, and a big part of why I wrote the book while I was in the middle of it was this question, because I have a 14-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old son. And I thought, what skills do I need to teach my children to prevail in a world in which reality itself is polarized? You know, it's not a skill that I had to learn or that millennials had to learn. But now, you know, what do you even teach a 9-year-old about? Okay, you're going to go out in the world and some people are going to believe that this president is really their president, and others are going to believe that he's a fake president. And somehow you have to navigate that without necessarily picking a side. You know, I don't think we should be forcing our children to pick a side in a culture war that we shouldn't even be fighting in the first place.
Interesting you brought that up, because I want to get into that, because what you're kind of alluding to is there's an epilogue in the book in which you wrestle with all these questions.
When I thought about how to write a book with this many different elements to it, I thought about Kurt Vonnegut, and I thought about Slaughterhouse-Five. And I thought, well, so here's a guy who, he had this tragic World War II experience that he was trying to figure out how to write about. And what he ended up doing was writing a novel in which he himself was a character, and that the fictionalized version of his World War II story involved a character who had come unstuck in time and was bouncing around between different periods of his life, and at one point was kidnapped and taken to another planet. And somehow this mixture that shouldn't work of science fiction and fantasy and reality and humor, you know, became one of the great modern books of our era. And so I approached it in a similar way, maybe instinctually feeling like, you know, I need to talk to the reader directly because this isn't abstract for me. I'm struggling with the same things you're struggling with. My children are struggling. Your children are struggling. We're all trying to figure it out. So let's try to figure it out together. That was my approach to the book. You know, there is an epilogue in the end where my daughter is asking me how the book is going to end. And I say, I don't know. You know, I worry about these characters the same way I worry about my own children. You know, what is the world going to be like for them? What happens when the oceans rise and the planet heats up? And how are they going to do? They're okay right now, but we won't always be there to help them. And what do we need to teach them in order for them to survive?
As we're talking about in that epilogue, you know, there's a line. I want to make sure I quote it right. As a writer, your author has long believed that fiction is an empathy delivery device. And I want you to talk about that, because to me, it's something, I mean, I don't even have the book in front of me, but that part I've memorized.
Yes. I mean, I've always felt like the subversive part of storytelling is that you are creating empathy for characters who are not like you, right? So if I can create a bunch of characters who are different than you and make you care about them, that maybe you will go out into the world with an expanded sense of empathy. But part of what I'm worried about and what I talk about in the book is that what if empathy isn't enough? Because empathy is a very powerful force when you feel it for one person or two people, but it's not scalable, right? There's a certain point over which, you know, you cannot feel empathy for 100 people. Right? If you see a homeless child on the street, your heart goes out to her. You feel empathy for her. But if you see, you know, a camp full of people who are homeless, the human animal isn't really capable of scaling empathy to that level. And so maybe empathy itself isn't enough to try to cross this barrier and create a system that helps as many people as possible. And yet, you know, in my job, what other choice do I have other than to try to say, here is someone that I care about, and I'm going to make you care about them with the hopes that if you meet someone in the world who's like that, you know, you might say, oh, I think I understand that person a little better and feel for them.
By the way, it's the treatment, and I'm talking to Noah Hawley, who is a creator in so many areas of incredible television. Still waiting for more feature films from him, but his new novel is Anthem. And I just wanted to ask you about the Edward Wilson, the Eramocene era that you mentioned in the book, but really, in foundational terms, is the Age of Loneliness is something that ebbs and flows throughout the book, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, there's these ideas that we touch on and that I touch on in the book, the Chaozoic era that we've entered, or the Age of Loneliness. You know, we've been talking so long about climate change, you know, how if we don't change our act and the temperature is going to rise 3 degrees and the environment will become chaos. You know, I think we're all waking up today to realize that future that we talked about is here, and it's creating a sense, you know, of disorientation, because we thought we had more time. And we're realizing that we don't have more time. The book contains a huge lightning storm, California forest fire, as, you know, as a big plot point deep into the book. You know, there's this moment where the boy Simon, when he was younger, he found a book about climate change, and he read all these facts about, you know, how the oceans were going to deoxygenate and, you know, the species were going to go extinct. And he thought, do adults know about this? Because obviously, if adults know about this, they must be out there like desperately trying to solve this problem in the nick of time. And then he sort of slowly realized, oh, wait, they do know about this. And they don't seem to be that concerned. And you can imagine for our children who are trying to figure out how the world works and how they should be in it, it's very confusing to look at what is clearly a crisis that's going to resolve in the death of millions of people, and to see that they don't really seem to be that motivated to fix it. It's confusing.
As you're talking about, you know, these facts that people should be absorbing, I was thinking about that terrific section with Avon, who's maybe my favorite character in the entire book, when Fat A is talking to him about the 14th Amendment, and he says that great line, well, Uncle Sam went off the gold standard because he realized he had something more valuable than gold, people. And this takes us back to what I brought up to you at the beginning, and that thing that you keep going back to that's so rich and fertile an area for you, that's the idea that people are saying something and nobody's hearing it. And it's not like it goes away. It continues to be said, and people aren't still not hearing it. You were taking us back even to the movie Fargo, where Bill Macy is constantly trying to explain his idea for his business, and nobody's, if one person heard his idea, his life would have been changed.
You know, that idea, this Avon DeWitt character who is a sovereign citizen, you know, who believes that when the government went off the gold standard, that they created with a secret cabal of bankers this financial system that we enter into when we're born and we get a social security number, et cetera, et cetera. And somewhere there's a bank account with our name on it that if we can just file the right paperwork, you know, with the right punctuation, perhaps written in red crayon, that we can get access to that $1 million or $20 million or whatever is in there. I mean, it's a belief system, and one that has a tribe of believers. And, you know, I spent some time talking to a local judge there in Texas who would tell me, you know, these guys are really dangerous because they don't recognize the authority of any institution over them. And they tend to get violent when confronted. You know, in the old days, that would be a subgroup, right? In the old conspiracy days of the 70s or 80s or 90s, it'd be a fringe belief. As we know, the fringe has become the mainstream, you know, and there's hundreds of people in Dallas today who are still waiting for JFK to come back and become Trump's vice president. There are professionals. I'm sure there are doctors and lawyers there who are waiting for that president to walk out onto Dealey Plaza and say, I'm back. What makes people believe these things? And if they can believe those things, then what are the things that we believe that seem crazy to them? And who's right?
It's interesting, too, because when you said Vonnegut and Slaughterhouse-Five, I was thinking in so many ways that Simon, in the way you use him in the book, brought to mind Billy Pilgrim for me, that he moves through so many worlds. And by just going across the country, you condense that idea where he, in some ways, he is kind of unstuck just because the country itself isn't stuck in any kind of fixed idea as to what's real and what is not.
Well, and he's pulled through the different realities that are around him and becomes a player in those realities. He's not an observer who manages to maintain the bubble that he started in. He goes on this journey, and eventually he's as active a participant in the subculture as, you know, as any of the people that he's with. And yet at no point does he feel oriented, you know, or that he's mastered the realities in which he's moving between. You know, there's a big section in the book about denial and denialism, how the desire of cigarette companies to get people to smoke, even though it was bad for them, involved undermining the very idea of science and expertise itself. And this whole thing about denial, the power of it is that, you know, if we can deny our own deaths, right, if we can go through life putting the idea out of our head that we're going to die someday, what can't we deny?
My guest, who is always welcome here, is Noah Hawley. His new book, his new novel, is Anthem. Our production staff, who includes Katie Gilchrist, who is engineering the show today. The show is edited and produced by Rebecca Mooney. Two better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.